9:25. I mean, really, when you think of the last number of years, and you watch the 6-1 news, and then you see the American flag flapping over the Capitol, and then beneath it lying one of the most indefatigable journalists in the organisation that we work in, certainly Brian O'Donovan, telling us what's happening, to whom, why, and where. Relentless, I have to say, and I've enjoyed him on the TV from my couch. But I'm glad to say that he's landed in front of me this morning in studio talk to us about his new book, which is an intriguing look at an extraordinary time. Brian, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming in today. When you were growing up, were you interested in politics and American politics, or was it always Irish? What was the...
No, always interested in US politics. I think all Irish people are. We all have this fascination and this interest in the US. Many of us have family over there. It's been a fascination of mine, certainly, for a long time. I was always interested in broadcasting, media, TV, radio. Growing up as a kid, got this wonderful opportunity to start working with RTE back in 2015, and then was absolutely delighted to get the Washington Correspondency a few years later.
Congratulations on that, obviously. But I've always been struck by your tone of voice as well. Can I talk about that for a second?
You can.
Because I got the sense that you'd be brilliant. I'd say you're a good singer, that you'd be handy in a choir.
It's been known. I've never been in a choir, but it's been,
Let's imagine it's the wedding is over.
Yeah.
It's not your own, but the wedding is over. Everyone's doing their bit, and someone says, "Come on, Brian, we're well in now. We're heading towards 2 a.m. And there've been good times had. What song will they play?"
Well, I have to say, I'm always happy to sing, but I'm not very good with the lyrics. I tend to forget the words. Now, of course, these days it's much easier. You can just Google it on your iPhone. But in Washington over the last 4 years, we've made wonderful friends with the U.S. The Irish ambassador to the U.S., Dan Mulhall, who's a big fan of poetry. So he's wonderful with the words. So one of my party pieces from time to time has been Raglan Road, Lou Kelly. But of course, that was originally Patrick Kavanagh poem. So myself and the ambassador have a little thing going on where he will prompt me with the lyrics and the words, being an aficionado of poetry, and I will do the singing. So that's become our little party piece.
So Raglan Road. And pre-Washington, what was your go-to song? Because I can hear you doing Old Man River or something.
Not quite, no. Always a Lou Kelly fan, so it tended to be kept quite Irish, and then who knows what gets thrown into the mix. Ryan, I feel like this is going down a route. Brian, we're going to get you to perform.
I would never ask you to do that. No, that's why TV was created.
Exactly.
No, forgive me for saying it, but I just thought you had this very, very particular tone that you bring to the bulletins that I was intrigued to ask you about.
Sure.
So that makes great sense. Luke Kelly and Raglan
Road.
Okay, you get the call to say we'd like you to be our man in Washington. How did that feel, the call?
Amazing, delighted. Obviously, it's a big decision to apply for it in the first place, and I had to talk about it at length with my wife, Joanna, who has always had more of a travel bug than I, so she was more than delighted for me to go for this in the first place. Get the call to say that I had it, so we were absolutely delighted. It's a pretty quick turnaround then. It was a matter of weeks, I think, so you get everything in place and embark on this wonderful adventure, and I go through it in the book, that journey of me heading out on my own first, which was tough to say goodbye to Joanna and our two daughters, Lucy and Erin. I was going to go out for 6 months. They joined me after that period of time. We had visits in between, but before they formally moved over. But what helped with the loneliness, I suppose, and the missing the family was the extreme busyness of the job from day one. And it was a real hit the ground running job. You were extremely busy with all the Trump stuff, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But then the other part of the job is you cover things like the Oscars when there's lots of Irish nominees. You unfortunately have to cover tragedies or crimes or issues that beset Irish people. And I think that's one of the big strengths of the RTE Washington correspondent, that you are there to cover issues of particular importance to Irish people and that affect Irish life, as well as the big Donald Trump White House, Capitol Hill stories that, of course, are important.
Oh, yeah, and we'll go to all those places. Black Lives Matter, of course, and as you say, it could be the Oscars, but it could go anywhere. So it's the most eclectic offering, posting, if you like. But the book opens in St. Peter's Square. So before we go to Washington, let's go to Rome. And tell me, I think it was there that you learned this sort of phrase or expression that would weigh heavily on you when you cross the ocean. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the book does not begin where one would think it would begin. As you say, it begins at St. Peter's Square back in 2013. I was working at the time for TV3 News, and I was sent over to cover the election of Pope Francis. And it was the most fascinating experience for me. The Vatican press office is this massive building inside a Vatican building that looks like a church, and it's staffed by the press officers who are priests. So you are surrounded by cathedrals, priests, religion, covering this huge news story. And I had a conversation with the press officer on duty, the priest that was on that day, and I'm all trying to plan my day ahead, looking at the bulletin times, and you know, asked the what I now realise was a completely ridiculous question: how long do you expect the process to take? How long will the Cardinals take to decide? You know, looking at my watch, kind of thing. And his answer was, whenever the Holy Spirit tells them. Yeah. And I was taken aback by that, and I said, wow. So in this world of journalism and deadlines, where we're constantly looking for the time frame, the structure, and the schedule, I was reliant on divine intervention, on the Holy Spirit. And the point I make in the book is that I suppose in one way it was good grounding for Donald Trump. And what, I hear you ask Donald Trump, the Holy Spirit, from the sense that unpredictability, a level of not really knowing what was going to come next.
Yes.
And I speak in the book about how looking up at the Sistine Chapel and the white smoke, and it came sort of at this unexpected time in the evening, and having to dash to a live camera position to talk about that, and the white smoke very much over the last 4 years, but replaced by presidential tweets from Donald Trump that made me dash to my live camera position. So that sense of unpredictability, but a huge sense of excitement and not knowing what is going to be coming next. And that was certainly the hallmark of my first 3 years, because, of course, I spanned the 3 years of the Trump presidency and then a year of the Biden presidency. Just that unpredictability, that sense of excitement, and never knowing what was coming next.
Because the expression, whenever the Holy Spirit tells them, has this lovely papal, biblical feel to it. Whereas I think, to use a more religious expression, more Irish one, I would imagine out of your mouth on occasion was, Jesus wept. Because apparently he did. And with good reason in the last number of years.
Absolutely.
Because you must have. I mean, I was watching it like the way people follow sport or... And as you say, with those tweets, and I'm sitting there going, God, this is extraordinary. I'm watching your bulletins and I'm watching your reports going. And then you've got to chase off. It was a marathon. It was or a sprint or a constant sprint. I don't know how would you. I mean, it never ended. It was relentless.
It was. And as I say, you were dictated by that early morning tweet. Donald Trump was fond of tweeting as early as 6 a.m. Eastern time. So you would wake up in the morning, see the tweet. That dictated your day. That saw where you went.
It?
And if you remember the tweets, Ryan, they were big foreign policy decisions or big domestic policy decisions. They were the sacking of senior staff members. They were the Iran nuclear deal. They were the Paris Climate Accord, all done by tweet. Yeah. What I find fascinating now is that, of course, Donald Trump's Twitter account has been taken away from him, but he will still issue press releases all the time. And as journalists, we get them, and they're written like tweets, and they've big capital letters and exclamation marks, but they're not packing the same punch. And I'm sure we'll go in a moment to where next for Donald Trump and what's going to happen. I think a big problem he has right now is that Twitter platform has been taken away from him. He has been silenced. He issues press releases, but they fall on deaf ears. They don't go anywhere. So depending on where he goes next, I think his social media access will have a big bearing on that.
Again, I'm tempted to get into the micro, but I'm going to go keep with the macro for the moment, because when you think we had Bob Woodward on with us recently, Michael Wolff on, both with their books out, and now you're completing that lovely triumvirate for us this morning.
Esteemed company, thank you.
Yeah, no, please take your place. But the point I'm making, I suppose, Brian, is that they all reckon, of course, Donald Trump's going to run. I think it'd be a fool who would say otherwise. But my question to you is this, and somebody I see is asking this on the text as well this morning, which is, do you miss the crazy? As somebody puts it here, the circus, the Trump circus. Because it's a very different style of presidency now.
People say to me, it must have been an incredibly busy time, which of course it was. But on another level, as a journalist, the story was there. It was huge. It was dramatic. It was exciting. It presented itself. And things changed. And there was a big change. I look to this year and I look to, obviously, January was very, very busy because we had the storming of the Capitol building, followed by Joe Biden's inauguration, a most bizarre inauguration, which I go into quite a lot of detail in the book.
Yeah.
The fencing, the armed soldiers on the street. Washington looked like some sort of a war zone. But then things got quiet. Politically. Mm. And what happens in the US, and I'm sure Katrina Perry, pre-Donald Trump, will attest to this, as will Carol Coleman, Richard, Robert, Mark, Charlie Bird, all the people who came before me. When you're not covering the day-to-day White House madness, which it was in many cases with the Trump, America's a vast country. And there's lots and lots of other stories and lots of other things that you will end up doing. And what I found this year, when things got quieter, let's say, in a White House day-to-day presidential way, there was lots of other stories to fill the void, and it also gave me the opportunity to go out and travel and expand and do very interesting stories about climate change, crisis at the border, migrants, those types of issues. So do I miss Donald Trump? I mean, you certainly miss that level of an enormous, exciting, engaging story that people certainly found fascinating, but in his absence, lots has filled the void. You're as busy as ever, but it's certainly a different kind of busy.
You were a TV3 journalist when Donald Trump came to Ireland for that, I think it's fair to say, infamous red carpet and top of the morning to you greeting he got with the trad musicians and all that kind of thing. And he, of course, there was mutterings, and they were laughed at in some ways, the idea that this man could be president. It must be kind of peculiar for you to look back on that, the memory of the door opening and the Donald coming out, and take us through that, and then the leap from there to where we are now.
Yeah, what was interesting there, people will recall, he had bought Doonbeg in County Clare at the time. He got it for a knockdown price, was reported in media at the time, because it had been bought out of receivership. He came to Shannon. The controversy at the time was that Michael Noonan greeted him at the bottom of the steps, and there was harpists, violinists, and a singer, and there was some criticism that Ireland had sort of bowed down to this man as he arrived, who at the time, of course, was not president. He was just a businessman who was investing in the area. And I remember that day, the journalists checking the names of his children, Don Jr., Ivanka and Eric, with the press officers. And at the time, we didn't know who they were, really. But imagine. Now, of course, they are household names.
Yeah.
So the Donald lands. He does his press conference with people, and I was always struck by the vagueness of his answers. And as a finance reporter at the time at TV3, I would cover a lot of these events, these jobs announcements, IDA-supported jobs announcements, and there'd be detailed PowerPoint presentations and breakdowns of investments and where the jobs would be coming from. And you'd ask Donald Trump, how many jobs? Oh, a tremendous amount of jobs. How much investment? Yeah. A tremendous investment. Yeah. It would be the biggest investment ever. A very much, I think, foretelling of what his presidency would be like. Yeah. This vagueness, these Trumpian answers that didn't give a whole lot of detail. And there's a piece I chronicle in the book as well. We were making small talk before our one-on-one interview back then, which was in 2014. TV3, of course, had the rights to The Apprentice back then, but the show had been discontinued around that time. And I referenced that Bill Cullen, who played his role, had gotten into some financial trouble. His car dealerships had gone into receivership. And Donald Trump made a comment of, well, I guess they got the wrong guy, referring to Bill Cullen, which of course was a bizarre comment to make because Donald Trump himself had been through bankruptcies and his own financial difficulties. But I think it was an insight into the kind of person he is, this view that, you know, I am the best businessman, I am the best host of The Apprentice, I am the best president, in his eyes, as it would turn out. And at the time, all the journalists were asking, will you be running for president? Will you be running for president? He gave some sort of vague answers then, similar to his vague business answers, talking about things like, oh, we're doing some internal polling and I'm polling really well, so let's see. And it would have been a year later that he rather famously descended the golden escalators of Trump Tower in New York and announced his presidential run.
Let's, you don't mind me bouncing around your story, because the book brings us to some fascinating places. And I'm going to go to March 2020, which is now, of course, a month that shall live in infamy. And one of the main events of the St. Patrick's Day celebrations in the States. Now, I've been to those a few times in Washington, and they are among the most enjoyable times I've ever had, because you're in the middle of it. You're in the thick of it, to use the expression. And there you are at this gala dinner in DC. And it started off, you described this lovely encounter with the security detail. Let's go there and then take us onwards and into the evening, if you will.
Yeah, so it was a bizarre evening. It's the Ireland Fund Gala Dinner. As you say, the creme de la creme of Washington and Irish America turn up to this big dinner. That night it was going to be, as all that event is every year, very high profile guests. It was Nancy Pelosi was being honoured at the event that evening. Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, was going to be there, the Taoiseach. And we arrive in, my cameraman Murray and I are there early to set up, and a Secret Service agent comes up to us and she said, do you know where the media will be sitting? And she was asking me these organisational questions about the event. And I didn't know a lot of the answers, but I directed her in the direction of an Irish embassy representative who'd be able to answer her questions. And then we both sort of stopped and went, do I know you? Do I know you? And it turned out that this female Secret Service agent used to be our children's babysitter. So it was a very Washington, D.C., small town sort of story, where she had been studying at a local university. We knew she had gone into law enforcement, but we didn't know which branch. And of course, these are all very secret. And, you know, she ended up in the Secret Service. So there she was. So I made the comment at the time that my kid's babysitter had become the Taoiseach's babysitter, because she was there to protect Leo Varadkar. And she was scoping out the room before he arrived. And that was her Secret Service detail for the duration of the time there.
The meal takes place, and then you describe this detail that's straight out of a movie. The phone starts to ring, and there's a sort of kerfuffle. It's March 2020. Remember the date, remember the time, remember the Taoiseach at the time you just mentioned. Everything kicks off.
Yeah. So what was happening at that exact moment was that Donald Trump was announcing the first of the travel bans, and he announced that travel would be suspended into the United States from Europe. And people may recall at the time his announcement was a little bit unclear in that who exactly, which countries were affected. And he mentioned the UK wasn't, but he didn't mention Ireland. He spoke about US citizens. He spoke about cargo. He spoke about freight. He misspoke on a number of occasions in that Oval Office address. And it was one of those big formal Oval Office addresses from the Resolute desk that the president will give at a time of crisis, and it always starts with the same words, "My fellow Americans," and he will announce, made this big announcement. So there was confusion, and you had Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, disappeared out one door. You had the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar disappeared out another door. He was taken upstairs to a private room. You had Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, disappearing out another direction. Everybody's on their phones. Everybody's stressed. I'm sitting at a table with Irish journalists who had travelled over with the Taoiseach, who on an initial, very cursory level, like, "Oh, what's happening here? Are we going to be able to get home?" You know, that was the level of confusion, because is there going to be a reciprocal travel ban from the European side? So it was all very stressful, all very anxious. Nobody really knew what was going on. We, the journalists, gathered at the bottom of a stairs inside in the function room awaiting the Taoiseach's arrival so that we could speak to him as he left the event that night. But we were told he wouldn't be speaking to us, and he would instead address us the following morning on the steps of Blair House, which is the mansion across the road from the White House where dignitaries stay.
I'm sorry, did you know the seriousness of what was going to come from that speech? Were you given an indication that this is extraordinarily, possibly one of the most important speeches that will be made in recent times, or were you going to it cold?
No, we assumed actually at the time that it was going to be a reaction to the Donald Trump travel ban announcement, and what was Ireland's reaction, or what's going to happen next? But of course, as things transpired, and I remember that morning, it was a very early morning press conference that Leo Varadkar was going to give on the steps of the House. We arrived extremely early, dawn breaking over Washington, and RTE News was doing a live special programme covering the Taoiseach's announcement. And Brian Dobson was presenting in studio, and I was on phone to Brian Dobson describing the scene as I was literally going through the security checks, the sniffer dogs passing through the metal detectors. We arrived up, Leo Varadkar descended the steps, and everybody will remember that speech where he spoke about it was the first of Ireland's lockdowns, really. He was announcing that people would have to start remote working, the closure of schools, various other measures, and of course more were to follow.
It's like science fiction. It was something out of a dystopian novel.
It really was. And in the book, I speak to Leo Varadkar, was interviewed specifically for the book and went into quite a lot of detail. And I think people find that quite fascinating, just what was going on behind the scenes. Yeah. And I asked him those little questions of, did you get much sleep that night? He said, I did. I got some. He said he wrote the speech with his team, and then he finessed it slightly, and he said it was just one of those moments. He said usually being a Taoiseach can be a fairly normal job. He said you come in, you do your day's work, you check your emails, but he said this was a real reeling in the years, out of the blue sort of moment of descending the steps and making this big state of the nation crisis address from very far away. And I think that was an added element for him, that it had to be done at that time because the levels of virus infection in Ireland had reached a certain level where they just had to start locking down the country. He was thousands of miles away, but he had to make the announcement in the US. And then, of course, all of this coming in the middle of Donald Trump's big announcement. And then after making his announcement on the steps, Leo Varadkar then went to the White House to meet with Donald Trump. And bizarrely, the meeting between Donald Trump and Leo Varadkar that day was not the big news story of the day.
No,
the big
news
story is that Ireland was going into lockdown.
And everything changed. Yeah. And everything changed. You landed in Ireland to promote your book and to come home. When was it?
Yesterday morning.
Yesterday morning, 5 a.m. Was that the last, is that the first time since that speech you just outlined that you've been back in Ireland?
It's my first time in 2.5 years.
That's a long time. And I know a lot of people listening from around the world are feeling that too. How did that feel being away from, not being allowed back for 2.5 years? How did that feel?
It was bizarre. And again, I go into the detail in the book of when it became clear that, yes, this travel ban did affect Ireland. And my wife and I, looked at each other and said, well, this affects us. We're not going to be able to, we can go home. Ireland will never refuse its own citizens, but we won't get back in. So I suppose then we knew the world was changing like everybody else, and you have to make a decision. Okay, well, this is going to be it for a while. Life is going to be a bit different. I always make the point, I am extremely lucky. My immediate family, my wife and my two daughters, were with me. So a sense of homesickness and missing family, yes, absolutely. But my immediate family were with me. We were a unit and we were together. So we were lucky to have each other there. We had our health. So many people had an awful, terrible experience of this virus. I have been extremely lucky. Yes, we were restricted from coming home, but that is the least of our worries. Most people, a lot of other people had things a lot worse than us. So it was quite a bizarre feeling to arrive back in Ireland yesterday. Yeah, for the first time in 2.5 years. The restrictions are still in place. As we know, they're being lifted sometime in November. It's still not 100% clear. Yeah. Fortunately for me as a journalist, I can get back in at least. Fingers crossed, US Embassy, I can get back in next week.
I'm sure they'll look after you. They're good guys there. They'll mind you, I'm sure, and they'll get you back. Just as you're home, Mary in Cork says, now there's a lovely Cork accent for the people of Dublin. Where are you from, Brian?
I'm from a place called Farran, which is outside Ballincollig, about 12 miles west of the city. So hello to everybody.
And do you have family still there?
Yeah, absolutely. Mom and Dad are there.
Oh,
and
part of the gang.
Part of the book tour will take me to Cork, which is great. So I'll be down over the weekend. So I'll get to see Mom and Dad and my sister who lives
there. That must be lovely. I presume you FaceTimed and all that.
Oh,
absolutely.
But
there's nothing quite like the
It'd be great to see them in person. Yeah, so we're looking forward to that. And of course, so many plans in the year 2020. I'm sure like the rest of the world, they were due to visit us, we were due to visit them, but you know, that's the world we're in right now.
No, of course. Let me just return to the book briefly before we say goodbye, and there's no rush on it, but I just wanted to ask you about life, because you write about it, and I think why people will enjoy your book in a different way to the ones I mentioned by Wolfe and Woodward is it's seen through this Irish prism. And you know, the American story and the Irish story is there's a huge interlock. You must have found that the smallest town that you think, where am I? And yet there's the O'Reillys and the Murphys, and you know, it's everywhere. And your book is peppered with stories. So if you talk about the shooting in that school in Parkland, you talk to the Creens, and when you go to New York and wherever else, or in Washington, the chap who owns the pubs there and who helped out very decently and with COVID and so on, delivering food packages. Clive Anderson is the man I'm trying to think of there. That's what makes you different from other correspondents in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the Irish, and I said that at the top, that is, I think, the role and the importance of the Washington Correspondency of RTE, that yes, you were there to tell these big international stories, but you're also there to tell the little stories. And you made some really good points there about COVID. COVID saw the best of the Irish come out. There was situations in New York where a lot of the undocumented, and remember, Ryan, the undocumented could not get the pandemic payments. They couldn't get the social welfare supports that were brought in by both the Trump presidency and the Biden presidency. They exist in the shadows and they couldn't claim any funds. So you had some wonderful organizations in the Irish American areas of New York and Boston and the club together to help those who were struggling. And we met one man on the streets of Woodlawn in a district of New York, which is extremely Irish. There's tricolours hanging off every window. There's shamrocks in the doors and windows of all the bars and restaurants. And we spoke to him on the street. He had been a plasterer. He had lost his job. And he just spoke about how tough it was, but that the community had rallied around and they had helped. And we really did see that during COVID. We saw, as you say, pub owners, you saw restaurant owners, you saw people really chipping in to help. And, you know, that's the wonderful part of my job, is meeting Irish people who make the most fascinating differences. I remember interviewing a woman one time. She was a scientist in NASA from Dublin. Fascinating person. These people who are out there working, representing Ireland. And when a crisis hit, as it did over the last 18 months, they really shone as well.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking, I'm listening and thinking of Paddy Maloney, who, as you know, died during the week, and somebody mentioned yesterday that he was a master of soft power for Ireland. You know those events.
Yeah.
And maybe after the speeches, there could be a little gathering. And Irish music is not only a salve, but it greases the wheel of conversations and so on. I mean, I think we're good at handling Washington and America and the Irish-American friendship.
Extremely. And it's extremely important. And I know people will, you know, be a bit glib and roll the eyes at the presentation of the Shamrock Bowl every year, but that is a massive diplomatic
not to be scoffed at.
For
I agree.
Ireland,
yeah, I agree with you.
Every small country in the world is envious of, because you get huge access to the presidency. But you mentioned the cultural thing. I saw that firsthand. I'll never forget when Ireland was lobbying the UN for its role on the UN Security Council. Bono and Riverdance were all wheeled out, and Bono was at this big event on the lawn of the United Nations in New York. He made his speech. He appealed for the votes of the ambassadors, and I got a sense very much after that the votes were in the bag, because all these ambassadors lined up to get these autographs and selfies with Bono. So, you know, you bring out the big guns.
Yeah,
exactly.
No doubt about it. Quick text. I love Brian, says Trish, and his tongue-in-cheek broadcast. I think my husband may be a bit jealous, as I always say, my man's on now. So you have Fan and Trish. And Liz Thompson says, I always look forward to Brian's reports from America. I loved the drama he brought to his deliveries. Yeah, you always bring that lovely sense of the immediacy and urgency. He's one of the best, says Liz. Brian, congratulations on your book, 4 Years in the Cauldron. Thanks for coming in, and thanks for all you've done to keep us posted on that extraordinary place And I wish you and your family every happiness and success, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Brian O'Donovan joining us live in studio this morning. Karen was on to say my sister Sandra Feel in Holland from Glenmore in Kilkenny met with Brian for coffee while they were visiting my nephew who works in DC. And Brian was so good to meet, especially at a time when no one could get home to Ireland. He's a nice guy. And that's from Sandra's sister, from Karen. Okay, nice to hear that. You know you're back in Ireland when they're texting about that sort of thing. All right, Brian, thanks a million. We'll be back shortly.